Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Danny Giacopelli.
Today, we're getting spicy and designy with Kaz Hildebrand, the designer of cookbooks for the likes of Nigella Lawson and Mr. Otto Lange, who will be taking us through her own title, The Grammar of Spice.
We'll also be hearing from musician Zola Jesus, the synth-pop singer known for her icy, dare I say, slightly gothic stylings. She'll be talking through her latest album, Ockervy, a little later on.
We'll also be hearing from two gifted writers, Travis Elborough and Helen Gordon, about other writers' reflections on the noble pursuit of being a writer, as detailed in their handily titled new book, Being a Writer.
Perhaps they should have given this script a bit of a once-over, Danny. That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan is here with some of next week's news today. And we'll play you some great music, too. That's all ahead here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Danny, always a pleasure to spend my Sunday lunchtime at least, with you. I know that you enjoy it, otherwise you wouldn't keep coming back for more. And what a lineup we have this week. Stellar stuff. Obviously, it starts with Henry Rhys Sheridan, so lower your expectations slightly. But then after that, we're describing a beautiful arc through the sky. Lots of fantastic guests to hear from. I am particularly looking forward to things getting a little spicy later.
We have spice, we have synth pop, and we have Henry Rhys Sheridan. Here he is.
Hello.
Hello, Henry.
On with next week's news today.
On the 14th of September, CAMRA, that is the Campaign for Real Ale, a British organisation, will publish its Good Beer Guide 2018. This is something that they do every year. The Campaign for Real Ale have established themselves as a pretty solid feature of national life, I would say, at this stage. I want to talk about this because I think that Real Ale is interesting. Not only because it's a product which has an audience almost exclusively in Britain, as far as I can tell, but also it's attached to other kind of personality traits and predilections, which I think you wouldn't necessarily associate with. There's no necessary logical connection between them. So,
what is real ale? So this is cask-conditioned ale, as they say.
I'm not going to venture a dictionary definition of real ale here, but I think that it's defined by it. One of the big things is the temperature at which it's served, which is cask cool, which is basically the room temperature, but the room temperature of a subterranean cellar.
You can't keep it forever, these ales.
So it's kind of like...
It's a living thing.
Right. The parameters are based on
like a pet
purity
hamster.
And
they don't last forever.
And chemistry. Exactly.
Yeah.
But generally
speaking,
the whole world of British beer has come on in leaps and bounds. CAMRA at the vanguard of one particular arm. But, you know, I think this is all to be encouraged. I know there's still too many pubs closed down and that's something CAMRA care about a great deal. But my main premise is this. It's quite difficult now to go virtually anywhere, certainly pub-wise, and not find a decent beer. Now, whether that's a classic cask ale from the olden days or a...
You remember it well.
Or, a contemporary classic from some hipster East End brewery like that one of Danny's mates probably runs.
Well, I'm an IPA man myself.
Good choice. If a little hackneyed these days. You can get good beer. And surely, Henry, everyone is a winner from that.
As an American expat, Danny, do you ever voluntarily order a traditional ale?
No.
Because it really doesn't jive well with the palates of most foreigners.
That's room temperature.
No. You're quite wrong. I could serve you up dozens of my favourites, which you would love. Guaranteed. Let's do it.
But I'd love my craft beer IPA even more.
No. We'll go for an afternoon pint this very day, Sunday. There's some good pubs around here in Marylebone. We'll sort you out, Danny.
Okay.
What else is coming next?
On the 10th of September, it's Klezmer in the Park in Regent's Park. It is London's largest celebration of British Jewish musical culture, connecting London's diverse Jewish communities to the life of the city.
I thought I could hear the strains of that from Regent's Park as I walked in this morning.
I know nothing about this.
No? You're familiar with the genre of music, klezmer, though.
But I like how This year's artists include the Yiddish Twist Orchestra.
Sure.
Manuka's Caravan.
Who could forget them?
And the London Klezmer Quartet. It sounds like a great event. I'm looking at photos here. There's people on stilts playing...
Klezmer, we presume.
Klezmer.
I tell you what, Danny, after our pints, let's stop by the old Klezmer Festival as well.
Sounds like a great weekend.
This afternoon's writing itself.
Yeah. What else, Henry?
And finally, from the 10th of September to the 12th of September, the Festival of Preaching is going to take place in Christ Church, Oxford. It's a new event from an organisation called Hymns Ancient and Modern. You like ancient hymns and modern hymns, Tom.
Why are two-thirds of these News Look Ahead topics based on religion? I'm just wondering.
It's a Sunday. Why not?
Okay.
It's the Lord's Day, Danny.
One beer, two
Chris
religion.
Lord's Day.
I frequently fantasise about being a 19th century touring preacher. I think it is a vocation that I would be happy in, probably more so than anything which is open to me today. Standing up there in the pulpit, just holding forth in a big old gown.
Snake oil salesman.
Doesn't matter if what you're saying is true or false, as long as you're delivering it, you know, with the correct degree of fervour.
That's how we sum up Henry Rhys Sheridan's job at Monocle 24, to be honest. Spewing falsehoods with confidence. Anything else you got for us? I think that's probably it,
that's
right?
That's it for this week.
Well, it's been a pleasure as always. Tom, would you agree with that sentiment? A man of few words. Henry Rhys Sheridan, thanks very much.
They say there's a great story in all of us, but anyone who's ever tried to put pen to paper knows that good writing takes work, and great writing avoids clichés like, they say there's a great story in all of us.
And our first guests today know that too, having learned it as writers and editors themselves. They are Travis Elborough, who's spoken to us before about a sharply observed book such as A Walk in the Park and London Bridge in America, and Helen Gordon, author of the novel Landfall, and a journalist and teacher of creative writing.
Together, they've compiled a new collection of tips, observations, musings, and hand-learned advice from authors ranging from Samuel Johnson to Laurie Moore. The book is called Being a Writer, and Travis and Helen join us now to talk all about it. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly. Travis, welcome back.
Thank you.
Very good to speak with you. I'm always fascinated by stories of great writers writing, and it's the sort of specific detail, often the locations, that I find interesting. For you guys, with this book in particular, what was your process? I mean, Helen, perhaps I'll start with you. Are you a writer who locks herself away in a garret somewhere? Do you go to the library? Do you like noise? Do you listen to music? What's your process, first of all?
I like quiet, but not libraries, because I get distracted looking at everyone else. So I kind of need to be solitary.
Okay, and Travis, what about you?
I'm the same, actually. When I can do research in libraries, you know, all the non-writing stuff that isn't writing, essentially, you know, the planning, the plotting, the taking notes, all of that can be done in libraries, you know, on buses, in fields, you know, wherever that might take me. But the actual process of turning any of those bits and pieces and accrued bits of knowledge and trying to fashion them into a narrative, I do have to be on my own, or at least with the cat, which is something else that the Muriel Spark advises, that a cat is a good thing for concentration for writers.
You're someone who would go to like Walden Pond to kind of like get away from it all and just kind of be in complete silence and tranquility.
I think that might take a bit sort of more woodsman skills beyond my ken, as it were. But Thoreau is in the book, you know, advising people to live in order to write. So I think, you know, the book
stand up to live before you sit down to write.
Is that what he said?
Oh, that's good.
In fact, I think he wrote actually Walden Pond probably after he got back to civilization. I don't even know if he wrote it there, but that's another.
He had quite a lot of visitors, didn't he, as well?
Someone did his laundry.
Socialite in the woods.
There were deliveries of pies, I seem to recall, as well. But
That's important just in life generally. Yeah. Well, then what about the process of putting this book together? And maybe in this, Helen, you can explain to us exactly what the book is. Is it a guide? Is it a how-to? Is it more of a bit of a meander just to intrigue people? Is this process very different? Because you're compiling expertise. You're compiling little bits of brilliance from over many years and from all parts. Is it very different putting that together than, say, sitting down to write a novel, for example?
Yeah, it's totally different. So this book it's a compilation. It's a mixture of advice, musings, essays and experiences from authors who we really admire, and mostly recognisable names, I think. There are also a few people who will be less familiar. I mean, one of the delights of the book was, as well as finding out What Advice, Say Charles Dickens Gives to Aspiring Authors, was also the chance to maybe introduce people to some names that might be less familiar to them. So, for example, we've got a Danish writer called Helle Helle, who I'm very keen on, but I think is maybe not known as much as she should be in this country. So putting this book together, well, what was great about it was that it was a much more communal experience in the sense that, well, Travis and
the
I had a community, two, but also, I suppose, a community with all those other writers and seeking out their words and what they've said. So collaborative, maybe, which was great. A mixture of time at the British Library and time online thinking, how could you ever do this before the internet existed?
Exactly. I mean, Travis, it strikes me that writers in particular, they're obsessed with how their fellow writers work. I mean, obviously, the Paris Review has been doing this for many years.
Yes.
The art of writing.
Yeah,
the little tidbits of like, ooh, what time do you wake up in the morning? All of this stuff. Why is it? Why are we so obsessed with like how writers work?
Well, it's interesting. Ian McEwan, there's a quote from Ian McEwan in the book where he says, writers also write for other writers. You know, it's a competitive field, shall we say, and you other writers are your competition for readers in a way, so you've got to fight them off as much as anything else. I think we are just that phrase, isn't it, the habits of highly effective people. That's what we're seeking. There's a way that there's a code to crack. If you read that Tolstoy gets up early and, you know, goes horse riding before starting his chapters, then you think, well, maybe if I get up early and go horse riding, then I will be able to write, you know, War and Peace.
And what's lovely about that is in the book, Tolstoy talks about doing exactly the same thing with Rousseau and finding out that Rousseau got up early. And so Tolstoy thought, fantastic. So it runs through history, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you feel like there's also some sort of like you're breaking down the magic behind one of your favorite books? I mean, if you know that Tolstoy was like a human being, maybe it takes away from the novel, or you're shaking your head.
No,
you think it's the opposite, actually?
No, I don't think so. It's just great to be nosy and find out what Tolstoy or whoever was doing. For me, that feels very separate from the experience of then reading a novel or a piece of nonfiction by that person.
Yeah, I'm not sure it has a kind of Wizard of Oz effect where you pull back the curtain and suddenly there's someone pulling all the levers. In a way, that's actually exciting sometimes to find out what mechanisms have actually made this stuff work or come to life. And within that, hopefully, there's also something that can inspire other people to think about writing. I mean, James Salter says something or other that a great book might be beyond reach, but a good one is plausible to anyone kind of starting out. And that's actually quite a comforting thought, really. And also that all of these writers here at one time or another were not published or were not acclaimed. So dealing with that themselves as well, it can be a boon to the would-be writer, shall we say.
In general, I would say the book is more comforting than not. It's always great to problems that you have maybe have yourself writing or thinking about starting to write, to see that these other people have gone through the same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember reading the biography of David Foster Wallace, and, you know, you see him kind of struggling as a young writer, and, you know, he looks up to Don DeLillo and all these things, and you see he's like a real human being with real foibles and all this stuff. It's weird because, you know, of him as this titan of literature, but also he's a person. And that's, I suppose, what the book is trying to get across.
Yeah, though there is also some really scary stuff, like Hemingway saying to sit down and you have to invent the truest thing that's truer than true. And you think, what does that even mean? How do I do that?
Which is interesting. David Foster Wallace, I think, offers one of the more sort of salient points, actually, which he just says, you know, that writing is communication and the reader can't know what the writer's thinking. They only have what's on the page, and to bear that in mind. So I think that those kind of almost quite practical pieces of advice are more, people can take more away from that rather than, as you say, the Hemingway thing of, you know, the true or, you know, these somewhat bold abstract concepts.
Though Hemingway does also have a nice piece of practical advice in the book where he says, always stop writing for the day at the point where you've still got some energy and you know what's going to happen next, so that the next morning you just get on with it.
Oh, very good. That's a good one if you fear writer's block, as I'm sure many aspirant writers do.
Yeah, and just, Travis and I were talking the other day about how many writers talk about the reluctance of going to the desk in a way that maybe doesn't seem true for, say, art painters, sculptors.
Yeah, definitely. I think musicians and that can't wait to get into studios and you know, play their instruments or go for a jam or something. Musicians very rarely have musicians' block. It's just, and actually, Philip Pullman says, you know, he doesn't believe that the writer's block exists at all. And he says, you know, replace the word writer with the word plumber and see how well you get on if you've got a plumber's block, you know, refusing to do this thing. But I do personally think there is something of writer's block. I think I've experienced it myself. So it's interesting to have kind of differing thoughts and opinions about this. There are things within the book as well, things like David Mitchell, for example, describes with all of his characters that he gets them to write letters explaining some of their most poignant childhood experiences. So he kind of knows them inside and out. So there are little tips like that, which, you know, may not work for everyone, but it's a way of thinking about character. And certainly my field is nonfiction, but I've had to do critiques of novels for people occasionally. And I remember on one occasion doing that, actually suggesting that they, you know, make a list of all the characters' favourite places, you know, what their favourite foods would be. So you had an idea of them that in a kind of mundane situation, being offered cheese or something, you know, that they might turn that down because actually they hate cheese or something or other, because you've already kind of built that into the character. And these are kind of minor things, but I think it's always worth thinking about. And I think hopefully that's also what the book will do, is actually make people think about when they're reading about how you interact with that. And mm-hmm. quite a lot of the... There's a lovely quote from Terry Pratchett, actually, where he says that, you know, would-be writers should read like carpenters looking at trees, you know, for the potential, you know, thinking all the time about material and what they can take away from it.
Very, as elegant as you might expect. I just wonder about that idea. Often people, if you read a great book that you particularly feel strikes you as being so personal and so true about something, there's often that feeling like, what a magical connection. I wonder if, by researching the book, and you talk, there's lots of mundane details as well, does it help either of you, or both of you perhaps, to get any closer to what that magical component might be or might look like? I mean, it's a slightly overcomplicated question, but do you sort of know what I mean?
I think so, but again, in a way, the magic is... That's the most difficult thing, isn't it? Is that when all this is said and done, how it works
it's
and why it works.
It's the nature of genius.
Yeah, it's
we're
just
to
yeah,
define
it's just this
or,
this
right.
really odd thing. I mean, there's a quote. I mean, it's not related to your point really, but E.L. Doctorow, we have a quote from him where he says, "Planning is not writing. Researching is not writing. Talking to people about writing is not writing. Writing is writing." And in the end, it's actually getting the words down on the page and whatever that man then produces.
But going back to your original point, actually, there's a quote in here by David Foster Wallace where he kind of just says exactly what you said about the magic of the connection, and that when that happens, it's kind of, it's like candy for the soul.
Oh,
says.
There you go. See, that's what I meant before, in my inelegant style.
And Helen, of course, you've written a novel. I mean, what was not to simplify, but what was the more difficult phase? Was it just putting pen to paper every morning, or was it actually finishing the damn thing and being happy with it?
I suspect many people that write novels are not happy with them when they finished it. And in fact, that's attested in this book, where there's quite a few examples of writers saying, I just wish I could go and take my book off the bookshelf in the bookshop and do a bit of editing. I mean, what I thought was interesting, thinking about my own writing in relation to this, was the difference between writing fiction and non-fiction. So I'm working on a non-fiction book at the moment, as well as my journalism. And going back to that Hemingway quote about stopping while you know what's going to happen next, I found that, I actually read that originally in a Paris Review interview, and that was with me a lot when I was writing my novel. But I don't find I need that so much for the non-fiction, perhaps because for the non-fiction, I actually prefer to finish a sort of set of thoughts at the end of each writing session. Perhaps there it's because there's always a guide leading you on because you've covered point one and so you need to go on to two, whereas with a novel, two could be anything.
And do you guys think now, I mean, do you write with the internet open, with like 50 links and tabs open? Because I suppose writing now is much more difficult. Not to just say, you know, poor us millennials, you know, we're kind of like, but really, I mean, it must be more difficult with all these distractions, I mean, because there are more distractions now.
Again, that was the most common piece of advice from the people who are writing now in the book, which was just turn off the internet.
Turn off the internet. Mm.
Yeah, it's good advice.
I mean, the interesting thing is, I suppose, that one of the oldest figures within the book is Samuel Johnson. And obviously he's talking about writing at a point when, in the era of the coffee shop, where there are lots of journals and there's this new explosion of literacy and therefore there's an audience and a paying public who will publish this, who will buy articles, magazines who will buy articles and so on. So there's an eco-structure for that to work. And obviously we're now at this other end of this with this hyper-connected world. And it might be that despite the advice of people who in a way are intermediary figures between, like myself, you know, pre-internet and post-internet existence, that actually a new form of writing, which is entirely online, which kind of exists within this way, will emerge, and all of and those pieces of advice will seem as anachronistic as saying, you know, under no circumstances we don't only write with a quill, or you know, or something. I don't. I mean, I'm only speculating wildly. I kind of don't actually believe it myself, and I know, to be perfectly honest, I'm 90% less productive when I have loads of tabs open, or I'm looking at my phone, or fiddling around with something else. I think you do need those still moments, and as much as anything, actually, because you will then demand those of your reader, that they will actually give the attention to the writing. So it's a symbiotic relationship in that way. But I'm struck myself when teaching critical writing in the nonfiction field, how the sort of younger students are really into contemporary poetry, and they're also really into quite fractured forms of narrative. And they're looking back to things like Burroughs for inspiration for some of this stuff. But it seems to mirror often the way in which they're reading and absorbing material in the same way. So it makes me wonder quite where, you know, where we'll go with sort of all of this. But I think it's interesting that, you know, I think one of the clunky phrases we use to describe the book, you know, from Grub Street to Silicon Roundabout. And I think it's true, actually, in its parameters. And hopefully people at either end of the spectrum would enjoy the advice.
Maybe just finally then, what about the best time to be a writer? I mean, did you, as you were compiling the book and reading these words of wisdom, find yourself, I don't know, Helen, sort of thinking back, oh, if only, you know, there was a time in a, you know, maybe the mid-1880s that just would have suited me just right, or is the here and now always the most exciting time, precisely because we don't know what's around the next corner?
Oh, that's such a difficult question. As a woman, I have to say I couldn't have wanted to be at any earlier point in history. I suppose as a sort of jobbing writer, pre-internet and getting paid more money for journalism, etc., would probably have been pretty sweet.
Yeah. Getting sent on a really big commission to some overseas locale.
Well, yeah. That's it. I mean, Barney Platt-Smills' film, which is the follow-up to Bronco Bullfrog, where the character is a short story writer and was trying to write his novel. It's a very good film, actually. But he sells one story to Woman's Own. This is a film shot in 1771. And he basically kind of lives in Notting Hill for the next 9 months while working on his novel. And you think, I could quite do with those pay rates now. And also, not necessarily in our book, but you look back at, you know, the figures people got paid to write novels or even non-fiction books, even like 40, 50 years ago, you think, oh, I could probably still live quite comfortably on that now. But there we are.
Do you guys have, perhaps finally, a single favourite piece of advice from the book? Is there any one thing that really jumped out at you?
I think we both gravitated towards, but do correct me if I'm wrong, a piece of advice from Jennifer Egan, the American novelist.
Goon Squad, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And she talks about being prepared to write badly at the beginning, not just at the beginning of your writing career, but at the beginning of every new piece of work, right? So being able to put up with bad drafts and being able to cope with criticism and being able to deal with that in a way that doesn't completely destroy you.
It's actually a very good piece. It has both those bigger points, but also some sort of practical advice within it. But I think the idea of, and she, I think right at the end with the criticism, said, you know, maybe this isn't for you if you can't deal with that level of criticism, because unfortunately, as a writer, that's what you're going to get.
However good you are,
even Tolstoy, I'm sure, has his critics.
Well, you can read more of the expertise of a host of inspiring figures from, well, all through history, right up to the present day. Being a Writer is out now, published by Francis Lincoln and Quarto Books. Helen and Travis, thank you both very much indeed for coming to see us.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I think it's time for some music next on the Monocle Weekly. Does that get your seal of approval, Danny?
Indeed, Tom. What are you in the mood for? Perhaps the American synth-pop luminary Zola Jesus?
Yeah, why not? We're going to hear from her in just a moment. She sat down earlier with our Tom Hall to talk to him about her new record, Okavi. Let's hear a tune from that right now. This is called Soak.
Stay.
And that was Zola Jesus with Soak. The American composer, who also goes by the name Nika Rosa Danilova, or sometimes just Nicole, has just released her new album, Okavi, and she sat down with our producer, Monocle's Tom Hall, to talk him through the record.
Tom began by asking where the idea for the title, which loosely translates as shackles, came from.
Well, first of all, it's a Slavic word, so it's translatable in many languages to the same thing, which is shackles or fetters. And I chose it for several reasons. First reason is my heritage is Slovenian and Ukrainian, Russian, and so I feel like it unites a lot of different countries and a lot of different parts of me. And it also just unites everybody, you know, because I feel like all of us are shackled to something, or we're imprisoned by some one thing or another. And it's something that I definitely experienced myself and secondhand while making this album.
The record was made, I understand, am I right in saying, out in the woods in Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. How did that landscape influence what you were doing? Were you living somewhere else before you came and made this record? I understand you're kind of from that neck of the woods, as it were, but how did that landscape inform what you were doing and shape the sound of the record?
First of all, living there, you kind of feel like the only person that exists in the world. And so it's pretty empowering and liberating. I didn't feel any sort of pressure to make a specific type of thing to fit into a specific type of genre for a specific type of person. It was more just using music as a pure catharsis, and that was very freeing. But I did write some songs in Seattle, where I was living for the first part of writing this record, and I think it gave those songs maybe a little bit of a different color.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, can you hear that change? I've had a listen to the record, and it's really impressive, but it feels quite dark and quite heavy. I mean, were you going through some sort of dark, heavy times as you made that? I'm really interested in how those two different settings might have shaped some of the songs, because some of the songs do sound a little bit sort of maybe a little bit brighter or a little bit freer in sound. I mean, tell me how you sort of explore the setting that you make records in.
Well, when I was living in Seattle, I was very depressed, and it wasn't a productive time for me, and it wasn't necessarily a positive time. And so some of the songs that I wrote or started to write there, such as Wise Blood and Exhumed, for instance, are either very angry or very resentful or very sad in some ways. If it doesn't make you wiser, doesn't make it stronger, doesn't make you live a little bit, what are you doing? Once I moved to Wisconsin, I started to feel more clarity. And once those roots began to tighten over that part of the world, I started to feel like a little bit more whole, you know? But as I was feeling that completion, I noticed people around me going through their own sort of trauma. And yeah. So I made a different type of sad song when I was living there, because it was more an empathetic type of sad rather than self-pity. It was more of like, I'm feeling better, but now all these people around me are feeling bad. And it was, it was overwhelming in a different way.
I think like empathy and catharsis, they're sort of really underplayed, under-focused on qualities of anyone's records. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of the time people do focus on, say, you know, so-and-so made this record because she or he felt sad, but they don't pick up on how those songs actually feel really, really good to listen to, and I guess they must feel really good for you to make. And there's a lot of beauty in that as well. I mean, some of these songs are sort of achingly beautiful. Tell me a little bit about how you go about making records, because I did a fraction of research before doing this chat, and I got to watch your What's in My Bag on Amoeba.
Yes.
I really like your records, but I associate them with a sort of imposing, austere sound sometimes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you were obviously picking out records and highlighting people like Daphne Oram, and just talking about how these were like experimentalists and they really like to play around with sound. I mean, mm-hmm. Is a day in the studio for Zola Jesus, is it fun sometimes? Does that happen?
Yeah, there are fun parts, but I would say writing a record is very emotionally exhausting, and definitely embroiled in a lot of self-critical and self-hatred, whatever. But whatever, that's whatever. It is what it is. But I do really enjoy producing. I enjoy creating layers and textures and atmospheres. It was really fun on this record because I did that more than I have done in the past, like taking field recordings and kind of just making noise and being a little bit more primal with the way that I'm producing rather than so strategic or technical.
Right.
That's when I really have fun, when it's just based on feeling rather than based on like strategy, or not strategy and like a, like more just like looking at the little bits and fitting it together like a puzzle. This was much more like innate kind
right.
of.
I mean, it's interesting you sort of said that you really love that producer role. I mean, you're always collaborating with new people and stuff, but one of those people a few years ago was J.G. Thirlwell. From a collaborative sense, I mean, do you seek out those collaborators to make a certain sound on a record, or is it more about just the people that you admire and come into your orbit? Say with someone like J.G., did you know him? Did you have to ask him, or was he a friend and something that you just thought would fit?
For J.G., it was just totally synchronistic. He was recommended to me. I was a huge fan, so I was like, does he even want to do this? Is this something that he does? But then as we started working together, it just was really, it was a really fruitful collaboration. And so we just kind of kept trying to exploit that together. With people, it's more about the therapeutic aspect of working with people, because I think being a solo artist is very taxing and you often get lost in your own head. So the people that I bring in are usually, I just want them to say that this sucks or this is good, or you know, it's like I just need some guidance so I don't go crazy, and for them to help me kind of fully realize my ideas when I get stuck. But I don't usually like to bring people in for a specific sound, because I feel like that's my job, is to make the sound. If I work with outsiders, it's for them to help me realize that sound.
And when you take these sounds into the live environment, I mean, this is a very sort of techie, geary question, but it's something that intrigues me. I mean, the opening song on the new album, I mean, it's almost like entirely sort of choral. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sounds like there's about 1,000 of you singing there. Regretfully, I'm sure you can't muster 1,000 strong choir every time you play a venue. How does that work? I guess you will have a bank of recorded voices and stuff, but how do you pick which voice you want to be in it?
Well, it's usually whatever feels right, whatever feels like the main thread. For this particular record, for performing it live, I'm more interested in having the live performance be raw and there be a connection rather than having it sound just like the record. Even though I do use backing tracks, because there's only so much that you can do live, I want less and less of them around, just because I feel like I want the music to happen in front of you and I want it to feel like a real, real connection. So, yeah, you kind of just pick and choose.
Do you feel that backing tracks are restrictive when you perform?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I always wonder about this, because they seem like... I mean, I feel like there's been this sort of narrative in music in general where it'll come back, I'm sure, but maybe the traditional band format is kind of falling away and people are a lot more interested in sort of writer producers who are coming out of a studio to occasionally perform and stuff. And it's more about sort of bringing out someone's inner mind landscape into fruition. But because of that, so many bands now seem to be locked into sort of backing track prison, because they, as you know, as we were discussing, you can't have 1,000 people on stage.
Yeah.
I kind of crave seeing bands that are still just relying on each other rather than the technology to back them up. I mean, is that something that you enjoy seeing as a sort of gig goer yourself?
Totally. And it's something that I aim for, and especially for these next coming tours, I have quite a few songs that are just free. And those are the ones that I get so excited for, you know. But I use drum machines, and so there's only so much you can do, you know, when you're beholden to something that's programmed.
Yeah.
I feel like it becomes really unmusical because you're just kind of along for the ride. And I'm just like, ah, just let me breathe. Let me be me.
Yeah.
You just want to perform. And so I'm excited to continue to push in that direction of, like, just getting away from that and feeling a little amorphous. It's scarier, but it's, in some ways, it just feels more, you know, again, feels more real.
Finally, just a slightly nerdy question about Sacred Bones, the excellent label which you've put out some of your work on, and this album, again, Sacred Bones. When you're having the artwork discussion at Sacred Bones, maybe you or maybe you've ever overheard, does anyone object to having the little triangle on the cover? Because it's a super cool little logo, but I just want, you know, you're artists, it's like you get to choose what's on the cover. Is there ever a conversation where it's like, it's got to have the triangle, it's got to have the triangle?
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a template.
And there's two, aren't there? There's a big one and a small one.
Okay, yeah, and there are different. There are different templates for LPs and EPs and all that, and it's very strict. I think the template gets a little bit looser the more records you put out with them, but it's always got to be there. And I do think that Sacred Bones has had some challenges with other artists because of their artistic license.
But I also think it's amazing. I think it's a really cool, you know, it's like building a sort of house, almost like, I don't want to use the word, but almost like a house brand, which is really strong. And it's like, you know, it's kind of like harking back to, say, whatever, like Motown. If you saw the mark of Motown on a record, you'd be like, I know it's a good record.
Yeah.
As much as I find the sort of concept of an artist having an awkward conversation with them funny, I also think it's like a real mark of quality on every record.
Yeah, like my favorite records are these None Such Explorer series records, and like a bunch of early electronic and modern classical records are put out under that series, and they all have the same template where it says None Such, and then it has all the information that has like a picture, like a box and a picture. And I'm just like, whenever I see this picture or those records, I know they're going to be good, you know? And so it's kind of good in that it builds trust, you know, a visual trust.
The record is a Covey. I recommend everyone goes out and gets it. It will have a tiny little triangle in the top right corner. Nika, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Zola Jesus speaking to Monocle's very own Tom Hall. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Buckle up, put the armrest down, and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now. Now, we last heard from in-demand designer and cookery book creator Kaz Hildebrand in 2015 when she joined us on this very programme, The Monocle Weekly, to discuss her analytical take on Italian cooking, The Geometry of Pasta. That book, as well as being all about delicious recipes, used Kaz's design expertise to highlight the efficient beauty of Italian cooking.
And she's now back with a new book, The Grammar of Spice, containing recipes, food and drink pairings, and the cultural backstories of some of the most aromatic additions to be found in any kitchen. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, Kaz.
Thank you.
So, first pasta, now spice. Why spice?
What can I say? Life without spice is pretty flat,
right?
Pretty dull.
It probably lends itself to a lot of fun stories, because really the history of spice, I suppose, is the history of everything, culture, politics,
absolutely,
geography.
Yeah, it pretty much is the history of the universe as we know it. It's quite a rich subject, obviously.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit more about that because it always intrigues me with books of this character. And we'll talk a bit more about the beautiful design and actually the literal design inspiration, because that story is interesting too, and it goes back to the mid-19th century and all this kind of thing. But when you set out on a book like this, are you aware then from the beginning that as well as being about spice and about the food, it's also social history, and often those are the most compelling stories, really, in a way.
Of course they are. And I mean, the story of spices is extraordinary. I mean, it's sort of, and it's vast. And I mean, this book doesn't in any way attempt to tell everything there is to tell about spices. But if I can just whet your appetite, really, and tell a few of the stories, the amazing stories, then that's a great start and maybe leads you on to further exploration of your own.
Are there things that are particularly sort of burned into your conscience that you think, this is a tale which will be with me, you know, till my end of days? And also, I wonder which inform the way that you engage with these things as you encounter them, as you go about your life. Are there particular ones where you almost want to sort of stop strangers in the street and say, I see you've got that there. Do you know?
Well, I guess it's not unknown, but the story of mustard is a pretty good one. I mean, mustard is so ubiquitous. And Coleman's mustard, you know, Mr. Coleman's sort of quoted as saying something like, I made my fortune from the stuff people leave on the side of the plate. But mustard's a fabulous thing. And it's the interesting thing about many of these spices is how ubiquitous they are in so many different cuisines, different countries. They mean different things, but they're important in so many places. And it seems like wherever they go, they get reinterpreted. And I find that really, really interesting.
I read also that alligator pepper, in Yoruba culture, it's given to newborn babies. That seems
ill-advised. I don't know. Yeah.
If they can stand that, they could probably stand anything.
Is that the purpose, I suppose? Yeah.
Maybe.
I might put that into action now with my 2-year-old and see how we fare. Now, we should, I guess, the grammar of spice, the very title of the book, picks up on the grammar of ornament, I mentioned the sort of mid-19th century. Tell us a little bit about how that sort of idea informed the design of the book, obviously, and the whole kind of experience.
Well, as an art student, you know, you was mining the library for interesting stuff, and there was this dusty old book that no one ever looked at in the corner somewhere. And I did look at it a few times, and it was sort of interesting to me, but I didn't really understand its purpose, and that was the grammar of ornament. But it's one of those books that you have in your library and you occasionally look at it. And I found a copy in the London Library, an original copy. And unlike the copies I'd seen at art school, it was vibrantly bright colour, printed in gold, silvers, amazing things. And I felt that it had got lost and forgotten, and it's an extraordinary work. So that was sort of one aspect of it. And then, of course, it seemed only natural to me, clearly not to anyone else, to link it to spice, partly because Owen Jones, this great polymath architect designer, was trying to make a sort of taxonomy of the design language of the ancient world. He was trying to annotate things to give designers of his day tools from which to design things themselves.
And you discovered this before you did the geometry of pasta? I mean, the kind of the way you write the titles of your book suggests that there's a pattern, right?
There really is.
The X of X.
It seems to be that way. Yes, I'm afraid there's another one in the wings, but we'll talk about that another time. It isn't a sort of a homage to Owen Jones, obviously. And it's the same idea of trying to make order out of what seems like quite a chaotic world. And so grammar is naturally a form of making order. And I guess I'm representing spices in a formal way, just as he tried to represent decorative arts in a formal way.
And the kind of sort of the curational process that you went through to match up, first of all, you had to whittle down the world of spices into, I don't know how many you have in the book, and then also find which designs go with which spice. What was that process like?
Well, when I started, I thought, oh, it's going to be so easy. It'll be decorative arts from the countries where the spices came from. Sounds simple, right? Sounds obvious. Only there are a few issues. One, he completely ignored the Americas, Owen Jones. Certainly Australasia was totally out of his vision, and most of Africa too. And as you know, many spices come from those places. So a lot of artistic license had to be taken. And that led me to looking at things that represented either the flavour or something of the feeling of those spices. So it's a sort of synesthetic way of thinking about them, perhaps, or things that could double as decorative arts from the countries that were omitted from his book. And then I've also taken a terrible liberty, and I've taken some of his tiny details and created new patterns and expanded them and developed them and created new, hopefully more relevant links to the spices. At least they're relevant in my head.
Well, no, this is what I was going to ask you about, because I wanted to know how, whether these sort of graphic plates are, yeah, are they sort of faithful reproductions? Have they been, I don't know, redesigned, refreshed? What's that process like? Because it's interesting you mentioned, I sense you allude to it there, that responsibility you have of another person's vision. Are you always very comfortable with your own reimaginings? Is there a feeling of responsibility? Is it quite liberating to sort of add an extra flavour, for want of another terrible pun?
Well, firstly, of course, you want to respect the work, but it was very frustrating because he does a little square inch of a pattern, and that's tiny, and that's not enough, and you can't really blow them up, and you want to know what happens around the edges. So I've guessed, and I've added and extended them. I hope he's not spinning in his grave. I hope he feels that it's a natural development.
And, you know, I suppose the copyright was probably expired of the book by the time you did it. So you could just take them and use them however which way you wanted, probably, right?
Yes, and arguably they are patterns of those cultures, so they're things that you would recognise. There's some Egyptian patterns, for example. You would both recognise something in the British Museum, but when they're presented like this, they look very fresh and very modern. And that was the other thing that I found amazing, that taken a bit out of context, you have to think twice about where they come from.
It strikes me there's some sort of, I don't know, what are these sort of recipes, or they're spice mixes and things towards the back of the book, and it gives some instructions about, you know, heating the pan and getting it ready. Now, with many cookery themed books, you can imagine them in the kitchen, splashed with oil or covered in other, you know, stained all the processes of the busy chef. It would be a crying shame, wouldn't it?
I'd love to see it.
Would
love
you really?
To see
I don't know.
It.
It's such a beautiful object, though.
There's a school of thought that says it's good to buy two copies.
Oh, well, of course. And naturally, my publisher subscribes to this. Yeah.
One for the kitchen and one for somewhere, you know.
But do you see it as a, I don't know, is it, to speak of recipes, is it equal parts design book, social history, cookery book? Does it matter how one looks at it?
In a way, not. I'd like to think that it's quite inspiring and that you think, my God, I've never tried the grains of paradise or alligator pepper. I must try and find them and see what I can cook with them. And that's a great starting point, which would then take you to perhaps finding recipes and things.
I wonder, is there like a purist's way of designing and illustrating cookbooks? I mean, must you always have a photo of the finished product, or could it just be alluded to through design and illustration and a bit of flourishes here and there?
Well, I'm a great believer in not having to have photographs. I mean, increasingly, all cookbooks do have photographs, but older cookbooks had no photography, and you were dependent on the writing, the quality of the writing to make you want to try that recipe. I mean, you know, famously, people like Elizabeth David, Jane Grigson, they were doing amazing work with maybe a little wood engraving of a lemon or something.
Right.
I think it's possible. We certainly tried to do that with Geometry of Pasta, have no photographs, you know, 150 photographs of pasta, probably not so interesting.
I mean, in the Instagram age, I suppose people want to see this perfectly formed photograph of symmetry and deliciousness, right?
I think that's true, but I think there's also beautiful symmetry in patterns, and they take you somewhere else. And I think maybe it's allowing you to free your imagination a bit, rather than think, if I don't make it look like that, I may be failing miserably. And that's quite depressing. I want people to feel they can expand upon something rather than close down their efforts.
Right. It's funny to pick up on what Danny said, actually, because it just strikes me that it's so evocative of the spices, and not just their appearance, but their smell and their texture. And you only realise that they're not depicted. It is only the graphics, but they're very clever. I mean, obviously, some of them, they pick up on forms. I opened it at random at Anise page, and clearly there's shape. Poppy seeds, again, it's more granular. Do you think that, I mean, is one potential impact here that maybe we review how we represent things in books? Or I think even things like wayfinding, you can use design motifs. You can do things that are much more intuitive, and actually we don't need to be as sort of objective and clinical and a bit cold in the way that we depict things.
I think that's right. And I think the literalness of our age is sometimes sort of lowering of creative energy, and perhaps the idea of having a slightly more open-ended thing that encourages you to use your own imagination and respond. I mean, it sounds sort of high-handed, but in a way it's great, right? I mean, why not? Why not open your mind to things in a way that you respond to personally rather than everyone tells you?
I think this is something to drink to eat to cook to, as we said, multifaceted. It's an absolutely beautiful thing.
Go easy on the pepper with your child.
I may not actually do that. It's published. The Grammar of Spice is out now. It's published by Thames and Hudson. Its brilliant author is Kaz Hildebrand. Kaz, thanks for coming back to see us again here at Monocle.
Thank you very much.
Tom, you strike me as being in a former life, perhaps a writer maybe in 1870, 1880.
I can still write now, just about.
Well, you produce content.
But
that's
it's fascinating talking to Travis and Helen there, and they're no mean writers themselves, about their own personal proclivities when it comes to writing. What about you, Danny? I could see you out in sort of wooden hut, I don't know, out in the Appalachians or something.
I find it very difficult to write in central London because there's too much going on, too many noises, too many crazy things. Whenever I go on holiday or on vacation, I find it much easier to scribble down something good. But yeah.
Thoughts that will, let's for the sake
of no one will ever read.
Never see the light of day. But fascinating insights. It's always amazing the things we learn on this programme. We should thank all of our guests once again. And let's thank, too, some of those characters behind the glass, perfectly written as always. Tom Hall, our producer, our researcher, Jonathan Whitfield, and our studio manager, Cassie Galpin.
The Monocle Weekly is back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Daniel Giacopelli.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.